right, without further ado, I'll introduce the speaker for this morning, Pat Y. from Pasadena.
Hi, everybody. My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm real happy to be here, happy to be sober. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting Vince and I to come here. We've had a good time, made some new friends, and it's nice to see Nikki here, nice surprise, old friend, and we're just having a good time. If you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you that, in my opinion, this is the best thing that could possibly happen to you. I didn't feel that way when I was new, but I sure do today. I had no idea when I was new how much my life was going to change or how different I was going to feel or what was going to happen to me. I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous was a place where people came not to drink, and I certainly wanted to do that by the time I got here, but I didn't have any notion that people come here and change and actually feel good. I mean, I sort of saw drinking as this awful, sort of dreary, long, endless. I was 30 years old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, there's every likelihood that I could live to be 80 or 90 not drinking, and it was sort of a depressing thought to me. But the way I was living was so awful that I came anyway, and I'm sure grateful that I did. I am an alcoholic. I don't believe that I've ever done anything that you or anybody else would call social drinking, although I thought at the time that it was, the time that I was doing it. I got drunk the first time when I was 13 years old, and the reason I drank that particular night is that I was at a party and these people were drinking and I wanted to fit in, so when somebody offered me a drink, I said thank you, as though I'd been drinking all my life. And they were drinking rum and coke, so of course that's what I drank. I got drunk, I blacked out, I passed out, I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know. Now, that's not what I meant to do that night. You know, I was 13 years old and I was a nice girl up until that night, and I felt real bad the next day. I felt shame and guilt and remorse. I was terrified that I'd get pregnant. I mean, I had a lot of bad feelings, and yet I drank again the very next opportunity I had, because drinking did that magical thing for me that I assume that it did for you if you're sitting in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It changed the way I felt. It made me feel comfortable. It made me feel relaxed. It made me able to talk to people at that party. You know, I've always thought of myself and described myself as being an incredibly shy person. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you told me shy is another word for self-obsession. I sort of like shy better, but I am self-obsessed. I think about myself a lot. I worry about how I look and how I sound and how I feel and what are you thinking about me. And I've been that way as long as I can remember. I'm the kind of a person, when I'm having a conversation with you, when you're talking, it's hard for me to concentrate on what you're saying, because while you're talking, I'm busy thinking about what I'm going to say when you pause. You know, I'm just full of myself all the time. And when I drank that night when I was 13 at that party, that went away. I relaxed. I talked to people at that party perfectly comfortably. I said things that made people laugh. I got up and danced and felt not at all embarrassed or awkward. And that's great stuff. I mean, basically, I drank again every chance I had after that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It worked for a good little while for me. You know, it did that magical thing for me. It took away those feelings that I had. Up until the time I took that first drink, I was one person, and after that, I was a different person. I didn't notice it at the time, but something happened to me that night. Up until that night, I was a straight-A student. I went to church on Sundays. I was very involved in a church youth group, and I did that because it was important to me, not because my parents made me. It was an important part of my life. I enjoyed a lot and got a lot out of it. And I got drunk that night, and I continued to drink at every opportunity that I could. And within 6 months, I was getting C's and D's in school. I had quit going to church, dropped out of that youth group, had a whole new set of friends, and I don't remember saying to myself, I'm going to change friends now, but that's what I did. You know, I started hanging out around with kids who drank, and started getting in trouble, and my parents knew that something was wrong. They didn't know that I was drinking, but they knew that something, they could tell by my grades that something was going on, and they sent me away to boarding school my last couple of years of high school, hoping that I'd be able to graduate, which I did. And I got out of high school, and I got a job, and I got married right away within the first year after I got out of high school. And I got married to this fella because he asked. He was a nice enough fellow, I guess. I don't really know. Our entire courtship was, at that time, there was a place in, I grew up in Newport Beach, and there was a place called the Rendezvous Ballroom, which at the time, which was there for years and years, and at the time that I was going there, surfing music was the big, this really dates me, doesn't it? Surfing music was the in thing, which is real loud music, and you couldn't drink there, but of course we'd get drunk out in the parking lot and then go in and dance and get our hands stamped and go back out in the parking lot and drink, you know how that goes. And you could not have a conversation in the Rendezvous Ballroom because of the magnitude of the noise. And of course, when we were out in the parking lot, we were busy doing other things. And yet, I remember when this guy asked me to marry him, thinking, "Well, we have so much in common. This is just perfect." You know, I don't think we'd ever had a conversation really, you know, about anything. He was not even, to tell you the truth, the fellow that I liked the best at the time. But he was the one who asked, and so. We started making these plans for this big church wedding. You know, typically alcoholically, if you're not sure about something, overdo it. You know, so huge church wedding, hundreds of people. My parents did try to suggest that we might find it helpful to wait. They were not fond of this fella, and they thought I was making a bad mistake, which of course I was. And you know, I always meant to be the kind of person who would grow up and get married and stay married to that person forever, and have a couple of kids and go to the PTA and the you know, church and work in the garden and just, you know, do normal stuff that normal people do. And there was a part of me deep down in my heart of hearts that as this wedding date was getting closer and closer that I knew this was a terrible mistake and that I shouldn't be doing it. But it was as though I were powerless to stop it. We got married. And I remember walking down the aisle on my dad's arm thinking, boy, I shouldn't be doing this. But I simply couldn't stop it. We were married for 6 months. And I left him, and, you know, he had no idea what happened there. He doesn't have a clue. To this day, he doesn't have a clue. He tried to talk to me. He was willing to go to marriage counseling. He was willing to do anything to try to put this together, to try to find out what was wrong. And I refused because I didn't know. And I just couldn't bear the thought of talking about it. So I just kind of left and never talked to him again. I like to mention this when I talk because it's important for me to remember it, and maybe there's somebody out there that needs to hear it too, and that is this. Clearly, I owe this man some amends. When I was about 10 months sober, I ran into him. I hadn't seen him in all those years, and I ran into him when I was about 10 months sober, and my first thought was, wow, this is really something. I'm in AA now, and God just puts this guy right in my path. After all these years, I guess I'm supposed to make amends. And then my very next thought was, well, you know, I'm not really sober all that long, and I'm not actually to that step yet. So I probably ought not to do this, and I didn't do it, and I regret that because I have not seen him from that day to this, and I regret that I let that opportunity pass by. It's my recommendation, if you're new, that you know, if these opportunities present themselves, it's a good idea just to go ahead and do it and take care of it. I still have that on my amends list, and it's not crossed off, and I wish I had done it when I had the opportunity. I can guarantee I'm ready now, and if God does put him in my path again, I'm certainly going to take care of that, and I've tried to track him down a few times over the years, and I expect that he'll turn up one of these days, and I'll get to do that, but I sure wish I'd done it then, you know. Anyway, we got divorced, and I moved to L.A., the big city, you know, and I got a job and an apartment, and I remember thinking as I was moving into my first little apartment that now I could be the person I was meant to be. I remember having that exact thought, and apparently the person I was meant to be was a daily drunk, because that's what I became. From the very first day that I moved in that first apartment, it was really the first time in my life that I was on my own without my parents or husband or somebody there, and now I was alone, and I drank every day. My first job was for a trucking company in L.A. I was a secretary at this trucking company, and I started drinking every night after work with these truck drivers in these bars where they drank. You know, over the years, I've drank in nice places. I've drank in worse places, not much worse than these, but some worse than these. And I think of all the places I drank, I like those truck driver bars the best. I was often the only woman in them, which pleased me a lot. I got a lot of attention that way, and I liked that. I always liked attention. I was trouble. I wasn't yet even legally old enough to drink. I'm 18 and a half years old. I have an ID that says I'm something like 23. I look about 14. You know, it's a joke, and everybody knew it. But I drank, and I caused trouble. And there were about four or five of these little bars that we'd rotate, amongst. And periodically, I'd get kicked out of one of them for causing trouble. And God, we'd all just laugh, and the whole gang would go to one of the other bars for a while until the heat was off. And I just thought it was all so much fun. I thought I was so cute. I thought I was the most precious thing that had ever happened. I was even then, in those days, was drinking in blackouts. I've almost always had blackouts from the very beginning, and I didn't know that was a sign of alcoholism. I thought when I was, 18, 19, drinking in those truck driver bars, I thought they were kind of cute. You know, you'd tell me the next day what I'd done, and it wasn't yet all that awful, and so we'd just have a good chuckle over it and go out and get drunk again tonight and keep going. The older I got, the more difficult it was to feel precious, It wears a little thin with each passing year, I'll tell you. Even then, though, and alcohol was working real well for me then, but even then I started having what I've come to know here in Alcoholics Anonymous as moments of clarity, where I would sort of see my life for what it was, and I didn't like it. I remember one day sitting at my desk at this trucking company. My desk was like here, and to the right of my desk was sort of a picture window that looked out onto the loading dock where these guys would load the trucks. And I was sitting at my desk on this particular day, and I felt somebody looking at me. And I glanced over there out of the corner of my eye, and there were four or five truck drivers standing on the dock there, all of whom I had known in the biblical sense, you might say, looking at me and talking and laughing. And it was humiliating. I mean, I really, really wanted to die. I remember I turned and acted like I hadn't seen him and pretended to work and tried not to cry sitting there at my desk. It was so humiliating. And yet, when lunchtime came that day, I picked up my purse and I went down to the bar with the guys, and I had four or five drinks and a hamburger, because that's what we do at lunchtime. And when quitting time came, I got, picked up my purse again and went down to the bowling alley or the bar or wherever we were drinking that particular night, and I drank until quitting time, and I took somebody home with me, because that's what I do when I drink. I just get lonely, and so I always wind up taking somebody home with me. And I don't, when I'm living this way, I don't think of this as being promiscuous. I mean, I'm in love. You understand, I'm in love, and it just doesn't last, I guess. I don't know. If I could stay drunk all the time, I would not have a problem with this, but I sober up in the mornings, and I have moments like I just described to you, and what I did about that is I quit that job, and I went to another job and started fresh. And yet, if you had asked me why I was changing jobs, that is certainly not the reason I would have given you, because I never looked at any of this stuff closely. It was just too painful to think. Any time I found myself even thinking fleeting thoughts about how I was living my life, I'd have a drink, so I wouldn't think about it. If you had asked me then why I was changing jobs, I would have told you, I believe I'm changing because I don't think there's any room for advancement at this particular company, which I'm sure was true, but not for the reasons that I... And I went on to the new company. And I was a good secretary, and I never had any trouble getting a job, but I always behaved the same way. I'd start the job out, and I'd be kind of nervous and on my best behavior, and I'd sort of keep the drinking separate. But eventually, if a couple of months would pass by or whatever, and I'd relax. And then I'd be drinking at lunchtime and drinking after work with the coworkers and the boss and the clients and all of them mixed together. And pretty soon it's a big mess there. And pretty soon I got to leave that job too, because I can't stand facing them sober in the morning. I've quit more than one job without going back and cleaning out my desk after a night of fun with the gang. I went out one time with my boss and several coworkers after work, and we were bar hopping around downtown L.A. and we were all drunk. I was not the only one who was drunk, but evidently, I was just a little bit drunker than the rest of them, because when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. Seemed like such a good idea at the time. I got the job. Thank you. This began what I like to think of as my show business career. And I don't want you to think I'm some sort of a slut here. I didn't actually work as a stripper. I worked as a go-go dancer, and I saw it as sort of a cut above. At that time, there were go-go dancing was kind of the hot thing, at least in L.A., and there were a lot of nice bars that, as far as bars go, that had go-go dancers. I did not work in any of those nice bars. My first job was in East Los Angeles on Whittier Boulevard, which is not good. A customer came in there one night and said to me, "What is a nice girl like you doing working in a dump like this?" And I said, "Well, showbiz." And he said, "Well, let me take you to a nicer place." And he took me if you don't know L.A., this is meaningless, but a place across from the Terminal Annex post office in downtown Los Angeles, which is, like right on the fringes of Skid Row there. And I kind of saw it as the people spoke English there. I guess that's why I saw it as a step up. And I got this better job, this more, exciting, prestigious job. And now I kept my secretarial job because I have a mother who's interested in what I'm doing with my life, and I couldn't imagine telling her that I had taken up this dancing career. And so so I kept my day job, and I literally, for the next good while, lived this sort of double life. You know, I'd go to work in the daytime on my secretarial job, and I'd be dressed kind of like I am now, and I'd be very quiet and just sit at my desk and do my work. I was not getting a lot of sleep, and so I was very quiet during the day. And I would just do my work and not bother anybody, and they all thought I was just this kind of mousy little thing. And I'd get off work at 5 o'clock, and I'd drive down to Nick's or Joe's or wherever I was working at the time and take off most of my clothes and have a couple of drinks. I mean, you don't think I do this kind of work sober, do you? Have a couple of drinks and get into my costume and go to work. And I'd work from 6 to 2 in the evening or 7 to 2 in the evening. Now, that's a lot of hours to drink enough to be drunk enough to do this kind of work, but not so drunk that you can't. I know you know what I'm talking about here if you're an alcoholic. It was really a fine line to try to cover there. I don't remember ever undershooting the mark on those drinks, but I often overshot it. Fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, I guess, the bars that I worked in were not the type of bars that it mattered much. More than once, more than 30 times, I'm sure, I just passed right out on the stage, just crashed to the stage. They would just drag you off. They had a little sofa in the back room, apparently for this very purpose, and they'd deposit you on this sofa, and one of the other girls would go on and dance. And, it, you know, if I came to later and came back out on the stage, God, the audience guys would just give me thunderous applause. They were so happy to see me back. And I felt so important and loved, and I can still remember that feeling coming back out and that applause. I met my second husband in Nick's there where I was working. He was a customer, and I used to say that he recognized talent, but dancing talent was not a requirement of this job. It really wasn't. But he was there as a customer, and we met. And now, this guy was not what my family considered suitable husband material. I remember saying to my mother, "Oh, Mom, for God's sakes, I'm only going out to dinner with him." Famous last words. It turned out that we were married for 11 years, and my parents never met him. That's how they felt about it. They were not happy. So there we are. We lived together a while, and then we got married. And now he drank a lot. I would never have married him. I would never have met him, probably, if he didn't drink. But after we were married, it turned out that I began to notice that he didn't drink quite as much as I did, and he certainly didn't behave the way I did. And my behavior didn't change after I got married. I mean, it just simply didn't change. I continued to behave the way I always had. I cheated on him the first week we were married. I never thought much about it. I mean, I just never thought about it. Things were tense in our house. We started having these serious discussions about my behavior while drinking, and about that same time, I started getting arrested. And I didn't care for that at all. I mean, in my mind's eye, I'm still this nice girl from Newport Beach, you know, and how could this be happening to me? I remember the first time I got arrested, it was Thanksgiving night. I'd been to a dinner at my parents' house. My husband was not invited, and he had been to a dinner at his boss's house. I had stopped on the way back. I'd had quite a few drinks at my folks' house, and then I'd stopped on the way back in a Skid Row bar. Skid Row is not on the way from my parents to where I was living, but somehow I was there in this Skid Row bar and having a few drinks, and when I came out of the bar, there were a couple policemen there who had about 15 winos lined up against the wall waiting for the wagon to come get them, and they just pushed me up against that wall with these winos and told me that I was under arrest for common drunk. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. I remember I said to the officer, "Do you have any idea who I am?" Now, I'm not anybody, you know, but it sounded like the thing you say, and he seemed to know I wasn't anybody. He told me to shut up or something, and they sent a car and took me down to Civil Brand and arrested me for common drunk. I couldn't believe it. They told me I could make a phone call, and I remembered that my husband was at this dinner at his boss's house, so I called the boss's house. The boss's wife answered. I told her who I was and that I was in jail, and could she please have my husband come bail me out. It never for a moment occurred to me that might cause him a little awkwardness at work or embarrassment. And yet when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and heard you talk about making amends, for a long time I sat in meetings and thought to myself, well, I never really hurt anybody but myself, you know, and I believed that. The truth of the matter is I hurt everybody. I hurt everybody that came in contact with me. I always thought I was this overly sensitive person. I mean, I would see, you know, the children starving in wherever they're starving this year, and my heart breaks. I mean, really breaks. Or I would see, you know, a homeless person on the street, and it was like a knife in my stomach. I mean, I just saw myself as more sensitive than anybody else in the world. And yet, when it came to just common decency or courtesy to my family members, I had absolutely no regard for them whatsoever. I've never done anything in my life until long after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, unless there was something in it for me. And I never saw that about myself at all. I really thought I was a sensitive, caring person. But I wasn't. You know, I was selfish and self-centered, as our book describes. So I'm getting arrested, and we're having these fights about everything, you know, and things were tense. And also something else was happening there that I didn't recognize until after I came to AA and heard it described here, and that is that alcohol was starting not to work for me. I was still getting physically drunk, but it seemed like no matter how much I drank, I couldn't get that feeling back, that, you know, that magical feeling that I used to have in those truck driver bars, or that first night when I was 13, or, you know, sometimes I'd get it back briefly, but, it, you know, 10 minutes maybe, I don't know, and then it'd be gone again. Now, I kept drinking a good number of years after that, trying to recapture that feeling. I didn't know that that's sort of the kiss of death, that if you're an alcoholic, that's it. You don't get it back. I didn't know that. So I kept drinking. And so all these things are sort of happening at once, and I started drinking at home. For the most part, for the last several years of my drinking, did not venture out much. I pretty much drank in a purple flannel bathrobe in my living room every night until I passed out. I had a little job. It's important to have a job. You know, everybody knows that alcoholics don't work. See, I was thinking about this a lot. I knew that I wasn't drinking like other people. I knew that I drank too much. I knew that something was terribly wrong with my life, but I can't look at it. So I had this little job. It was not much of a job, you know. It was I had much better jobs at a much younger age, and my jobs just kind of went down. And so I'm working this little job, and I'm missing a lot of Mondays, and I'm often go to lunch and don't make it back after lunch. And it was the kind of job that, you know, didn't really matter much. I could still get my work done. And I got demoted one day. It was like the lowest job, and I got demoted one day, and things were not going well. And I was drinking every day, and I knew that, I mean, I'm a bright woman. I know I'm drinking too much. Maybe if I don't drink anymore, I can get my life together, because my life is going nowhere. So I make this big decision. I'm not going to drink anymore. I always made this decision while I was drinking. And I'll just, you know, drink tonight, and then tomorrow morning it'll be a new day. And I'd get up. Now I'm getting a little older, and I'm not bouncing back quite so fast in the mornings like I did when I was younger. You know, I'm suffering from these terrible hangovers. And so I'd get up, and I'd say to myself, okay, that's it. You know, I am not going to drink anymore. And I'd take my shower, and I'd go off to work, and I'd be driving to work, and I'd think, not only am I not going to drink, I think I'm going to start doing some physical exercise and really get in shape, and it'll make me feel better. And I'd pull into the parking lot at work, and I'd think, you know, maybe I'll go back to college and finish my education. It's going to be a whole new me. It's going to be fantastic. But I'm an alcoholic, you know, and by the time the day's over, assuming I didn't drink at lunch, by 5 o'clock I need a drink bad. I'm a daily drunk, and I need a drink bad by 5 o'clock. I remember walking in the house, and there'd be like, you know, a half a fifth of scotch sitting there, and I'd think to myself, well, it would be real hard to quit with this open bottle here. What I'll do is I'll drink this down, and tomorrow when there's nothing in the house, I'll quit. It'd be a lot easier to quit when there's no booze. I mean, that makes a lot of sense, I'm sure, to everybody in this room. And so I would start drinking. But I'm an alcoholic, and before that bottle even gets near the bottom, I'm calling the liquor store to deliver another one. And what I have the next day is more or less a half a fifth of scotch there, and I didn't do that once or twice. I did it a lot, and I meant it every time. Tomorrow, when there's nothing here, I'm going to quit drinking. I never could seem to pass out on the last drop. You know, it never happened. I sat in my apartment. I hated myself. I hated my husband. I hated my life. I hated everything. I would play those sad records over and over and over again, you know. I was particularly fond of Ray Charles' Born to Lose. Just would play that and cry and call everybody I knew on the telephone, boyfriends I'd had when I was 12. I didn't care what time it was. I didn't notice what time. It's not that I didn't care. I didn't notice what time of the night it was. By the time I got sober, my mother was the only one who still took my calls. Everybody else would just hang up the phone on me, and as soon as they knew who it was. And my mother would always take my calls and always talk to me and try to comfort me. And, you know, my mother has always loved me in spite of how I was living my life. And if I never got anything else out of Alcoholics Anonymous except the fact that I don't torment her anymore, what a gift. You know, what an incredible gift. I was sitting in my apartment one hot summer day. It was about 110. I'm wearing that purple flannel bathrobe, sweating buckets and drunk. It was about 10 in the morning. I'm drunk already. It must have been, I think it might have been the 4th of July. It was a real hot day. I know that. And I was watching the neighbors. We lived in a second floor apartment. We could see down into the neighbor's yard. The neighbors were a young couple, about my age, late 20s at this time, I guess. And they had a couple of little kids, toddlers, and the kids were playing and running in the sprinklers on the lawn, and the mom and the dad were sitting on the porch steps watching the kids play and talking and laughing and drinking coffee or something. And I cried watching those people up there from my apartment because I wanted what they had. That's how I meant to live my life. That's how I always meant to be living my life, and I don't know how this happened to me. I don't know how I got in this kind of condition. And I knew that day beyond a shadow of a doubt there was absolutely no hope that it was ever going to change because I'd been trying to change it for a long time, and nothing was happening. I'd like to tell you that I called AA that day, but it didn't. I don't know how long it was from that day until the day I called Alcoholics Anonymous. It could have been 3 months. It could have been 3 years. I really don't know. But one night, drunk, I did call AA. I have no idea what triggered the notion to do that on that particular day. I just remember dialing information and asking for the number, writing it on a little scrap of paper, and then dialing the number. A real nice man answered the phone, Alcoholics Anonymous, may I help you? And I started to cry. And this man talked to me for a long time, told me a lot about himself. And I remember he wanted to send a couple of women over to my house. I could not think of a worse idea than a couple of women coming to my house. And I said something to him like, oh, no, thank you very much. I don't think I'm that bad. And he seemed to sort of understand my attitude. And it was a Friday night when I called. He asked me if I thought I could not take a drink the next day and go to a meeting the next night that was near where I was living. And I said, oh, sure. I have no idea if I can do that or not, but sure seemed like the right answer. And so he gave me the address of a meeting place near where I was living. And we hung up eventually. And, of course, I continued to drink. And eventually passed out that night. Now, I woke up the next morning, and I remembered making that phone call. I didn't remember much of it, but I remembered enough of it, you know, and I found that little scrap of paper where I'd written the address of the meeting place down. And now, in the light of day the next morning, it didn't seem like quite such a great idea to go racing off to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I'd probably been a little premature. I mean, I was only 30 years old. That's awfully young to be an alcoholic. Seemed like it to me, anyway. But I couldn't get it out of my mind that day. I just kept thinking about it all day. And I found myself saying to my husband at the dinner table that night, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. I don't know who was more surprised that I said it, he or I, but there it was. I'd said it, and I got dressed with some care and went off to my, I say with some care. I changed clothes several times. You know how we women do when you want to strike the right note. Now, I've never been to AA, so I have no idea how you dress. But I don't want to be overdressed. I can't think of anything worse than being overdressed in any gathering. But I don't want to be underdressed either. I mean, I don't want you to think I have a cavalier attitude about this because I don't. I want to be dressed right. And so I remember I changed clothes several times. And when I left the bedroom, there was a sort of this big pile of clothes on the bed that I discarded as being inappropriate. The outfit that I arrived here in, which apparently struck the right note in my mind, was rubber thongs, baggy jeans, and a knit top that all the knit had gone out of. You know, it just kind of hung there. I had a red and white striped one and a blue and white striped, and they were exactly alike. Neither one of them had any knit left in them. And I wore alternately those shirts with jeans to every meeting I went to for about the first month. And one night I had been somewhere else with my husband earlier in the day, and I had on this sort of rose-colored pantsuit that I had, a really nice, attractive pantsuit that I had. And I went to the meeting wearing that pantsuit that night, and everybody at the meeting told me how pretty I looked. And it made me feel good. You know, and I started dressing better when I went to meetings after that. Anyway, I went off to this first meeting dressed in this outfit, and I got there. It was in the basement of a church in Santa Monica. There were a couple of hundred people there, and I got there at 8:25 at night. Now, I can't talk to these people. This is why I drink, because of gatherings like this. And so I went into this room, and I stood in the back of the room waiting for the meeting to start. It was 8:25 at night. I hadn't had a drink. The guy said, don't drink, so I hadn't drunk. But I am a daily drunk, and I needed a drink bad. By 8:25 at night, I'm often already passed out. God bless whoever opened that door. I'm standing there. I'm sick, and I'm shaking, and sweat is just coming off of me in buckets. I'm in these terrible clothes. I'm going to cry any minute. A man comes up to me and asks me if I'm new, and I thought, how did he know that? You know, out of all these people, this guy just came right to me And I said, well, yeah, I was. And it seemed like that. There were about 50 women standing there writing their numbers on little scraps of paper and handing me their phone numbers and telling them to call them any time. And they found me a seat, and the meeting started. And a man by the name of Norm Alpey talked that night at this meeting, and this guy made me laugh. As a matter of fact, he drank in the Rendezvous Ballroom many years before me. He was an older man, but I identified, see, when he was talking, and I laughed, and I cried a little bit, and what I got, of course, is hope. I didn't know that, but that's what happened to me that night. I bought a big book, and I took it home, and I sat up most of the night reading it, and I thought, God, this is great. I'm going to go to that meeting every Saturday night and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had heard you say that night that I should go to a lot of meetings, and it seemed to me that every Saturday night would be a lot of meetings. I drank again on Friday, but now 6 days in a row, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I did not drink, and I was impressed. I was really impressed. Every day, I remember thinking, God, AA really works. I'm not drinking. This is incredible. And then on Friday night, I was just sort of struck drunk. You know, I don't remember the first drink. I remember I was sitting in one of my regular bars for several hours drinking Diet Pepsi and, you know, trying to fit in. And then the next thing I know, I'm half drunk and there's a bunch of empty scotch glasses in front of me. And I remembered when I became aware of that, thinking, well, I can't be drunk. I'm in AA now. But I was drunk. And I went back to that meeting that next Saturday night and I raised my hand for being under a week of sobriety again. And I got some more phone numbers at this second meeting, and one of these ladies suggested I might find it helpful to actually call one of these numbers. I hadn't done that, and I thanked her for that information. I drank a couple more times that week, and I called that lady who said that to me drunk on Wednesday night, and she said, well, you seem to be having a little trouble grasping our program. You might find a sponsor helpful. I did not have any idea what a sponsor was, but I said, well, all right, would you be my sponsor? And she seemed pleased to be asked, and she said that she'd be happy to. She said, why don't you meet me early tomorrow night before the meeting starts, and we'll talk about it. Tomorrow night was a Thursday. That's not meeting night. But I did want to kind of get off on the right foot here, so God bless you, Jimmy. It's hot up here. She asked me if I had a big book. I said yes, and she said, bring it with you when you come tomorrow night. So I did, and we met early before anybody else got to the meeting place, and we sat in the back of the hall, and the first thing she did is she opened up my meeting directory, opened up my big book to the front cover and handed me a pen and told me to write that day's date in there, and I wrote the date in the front cover, and she said, that's your sobriety date. I thought, boy, I shouldn't have done that in ink. You know, I don't think this is going to work. I'm happy to report it's my sobriety date. August 28th, 1975, for those who keep track of these things. The next thing she did is she took the meeting directory, you know, that lists all the meetings in the area, and she started circling meetings with what I think of as the sponsor smile. You know, that's where all the teeth kind of show. And she's that smile, she's saying, now, on Monday night you'll go to this meeting, and Tuesday night that meeting there, and Wednesday night we all think this is the best meeting in town. I could not believe it. I said, excuse me, I'm a married woman. This is totally out of the question. And she said, she's very nice. She said, well, maybe you can do it on less, but if you want me to be your sponsor, this is what I expect you to do. She said, I will never ask you to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that I haven't done. But if you want me to be your sponsor, I assume that it's because you want what I have. And if you want what I have, I only know one way to get it, and that's do what I do. I couldn't think of a snappy comeback to that. Actually, I still can't. I said, well, okay, I'll try, but my husband isn't going to like this one little bit. And she told me it didn't matter if my husband liked it. She told me it didn't matter if I liked it. But she said, I promise you, if you come to these meetings and you don't drink in between and you take these steps and do as I suggest, I promise you your life will change for the better. I know I didn't really believe her, but I did start going to these meetings every night. And I can't believe it when I look back on it. You know, I just can't believe I kept coming back. I thought I had the saddest life of anybody who ever came here. My life did not get better. Vince was talking about feeling, you know, he hopes you feel desperate. I'll tell you, I felt desperate long into sobriety. I was right, my husband didn't like it. I'm coming to these meetings and we have now a new focus for our fights. We're now fighting about Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. He thinks, you know, see, for years I'm sitting in a rocking chair in the living room drunk every night, which doesn't make a wonderful wife, but at least he knew where I was. Now I'm gone every night, you know, and he didn't like it. He thought that I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to meet men. Now, I was not adverse to the idea of meeting men here. In fact, I was rather looking forward to the notion of meeting some men here. But when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, none of the men appeared to be interested in me, which hurt my feelings a great deal. Actually, I kind of thought that somehow by sobering up, my charm had gone, you know, that because nobody was coming on to me at all. And it not only did that hurt my feelings, but it really ticked me off that he's at home accusing me of something I'm not doing right at this minute, you know. So we're having things are tense, you might say, around the house. And God, I thought my life was so sad. I'd get up in the morning and go to work. I'd come home. We'd have dinner. We'd have the fight. I'd get in the car. I'd be sobbing hysterically and drive to the meeting. It's a miracle I wasn't killed in a car wreck driving to a meeting because I cried on the way to every meeting. And not little tears, sobbing, great, you know, sobbed. And I'd drive to the meeting and I'd think, it's not worth it. If this is sobriety, you can have it. I'll go to your meeting tonight because I'm already out of the house. But this is the last one I'm going to. I can't do this. And I, you know, thank God I always went that night. Because I'd get there and I guess I'd hear the one thing I needed to hear to keep me going the next day. And it wasn't necessarily even something that a speaker would say, or sometimes it was something I might overhear in the bathroom line, or, you know, it just seemed like if I put myself at that meeting, I got whatever it was I needed, and I kept coming back. You were so nice to me. You'd pat me on the back and tell me to keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time. Now, that's obviously not true because it's getting worse, but you were very kind to me. My sponsor had given me a direction that I had to get to every meeting an hour early, shake hands with every single person in the room and ask them how they were, as though I cared. And so I'd go into the meeting and I would say, you know, hi, Fred, how are you? And he'd say, fine, Pat, how are you? And I'd tell him, you know, in great and intimate detail, I would tell him what my husband said, and then I said, and it was just also sad, and to Fred's eyes would just glaze over, you know. And I'd move on to Mary. Hi, Mary, how are you? And she'd say, you know, and I'd kind of work the room like that, and you'd just keep patting me and saying, keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time. One night when I was about 3 months sober, and I believe this is the most important night of my sobriety, right up to this very instant, I was at my home group meeting, and I was crying, and I said to this fellow, hi, Larry, how are you? And Larry said, fine, how are you? And I started to tell him, and he cut me off in mid-sentence. He said, I don't want to listen to that. Why don't you go find a newcomer to talk to? Perhaps you'd feel better. I remember I looked at Larry, and I thought, I'm a newcomer. Why don't you talk to me? Maybe you'd feel better. I didn't say that, but I thought it. And Larry pointed to some girl on the other side of the room, and he said, there, over there in the red dress, she's brand new, it's her first meeting, you go talk to her. And he stood there looking at me. Now, I don't care if this girl in the red dress lives or dies. I really don't. But Larry's looking at me there, and I know if I don't go talk to this girl, he's going to tell my sponsor. So I guess I could go over and say hello, you know. So I went over there and I put out my hand and I said, hi, my name is Pat. And the girl who had 12-stepped her that night and brought her to the meeting said, oh, Pat, I'm so happy to see you. This is whatever her name was. It's her first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been waiting for you because she had this big fight with her husband about coming to AA. And I just knew you were the right person to talk to her. You know how you have things flash through your mind in like split-second timing? What flashed through my mind there was, well, I'm absolutely the wrong person to talk to her. It doesn't work. I mean, look at me. My life is horrible. I kind of overlooked that I was sober there. All I could see was how sad and tragic my poor little life was. But then I also thought in that same split second there that, well, it's not working for me, but it's working for some of you. And if this is this girl's first meeting, I really ought to try to say something positive or encouraging. I mean, I really should. And I opened up my mouth and I heard myself say, of all things, keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time. I felt like such a hypocrite. I mean, this is not true, you know. But I know I didn't talk to this girl more than 30 seconds. I simply wouldn't have. I would not have gotten out of myself any longer than that. I turn and I'm walking back across the floor, and I had one of those moments that we get. I like to think of it, it's like God kind of reaches down and taps you on the head and gets your attention and then tells you something. I just had one of those moments. I stopped dead in my tracks, and I realized that it was the first time in the 3 months of sobriety that I'd had, from the time I hit the door until an hour later when the meeting started, that I was there and not crying. And the reason for it was because for 30 seconds, or however long it was, I tried to think of something positive or encouraging to say to this girl who was newer than me. For maybe the first time in my entire life, I tried to do something helpful for somebody else without expecting anything at all in return for it. And I felt better. There's a line, there's many lines in the Big Book that refer again and again to the fact that when all else fails, working with another alcoholic will save the day. You know, nothing will so much ensure immunity as drinking, as working with another alcoholic. And it's the truth. It worked that night when I was 3 months sober and had very little to share in terms of, you know, happy, joyous sobriety. And it's true tonight when I'm 16 years plus and have have 16 more years of sobriety to share, which if you're new, incidentally, is all that I have. I am not any kind of an expert on anything. But I know how I've stayed sober for these 16 years, and it appears that so long as I'm willing to share that with you or whoever, I get to not only stay sober, but feel good most of the time. You know, I get to feel good, and, you know, what a gift. I never expected that. It was an important lesson for me, and I hope I never forget it. I sponsor women today, and I know that's why I feel so good so much of the time. And these women I sponsor can be a pain, you know. They call it inconvenient times, and they do stuff that I just can't believe. I mean, they get pregnant when they're not married, and they quit jobs when they don't have new ones to go to, and they just, you know, but I think about them. I talk to them a lot. I worry about them. I try to help them take these steps and apply these principles to their lives. And there are many days when I have no time whatsoever to think about myself. And when I am not thinking about me, I'm having a better day, and so is everybody in my immediate vicinity, you know? It's just a fact. To go back to when I'm new, I'm whining and sniveling around these meetings. I mean, clearly this husband at home is the problem. Clearly. I mean, if you were married to him, you'd be unhappy too, let me tell you. And, I mean, I don't have any part in this, of course. It couldn't be me. With an attitude like I had, it was inevitable that I would meet a man in a meeting one night that looked good to me. I was about 10 months sober. He was about 10 minutes sober. And I could see it like it was yesterday. He had a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head, and I'll tell you, he looked good to me. And I leaped across some chairs to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed. And beckoned me off to the side of the room and reminded me that I was a married woman. And I said, yeah, but I'm so unhappy. And she said, nonetheless, Pat, you're married. And so long as you're married, I expect you to act like a married woman. I said, this is not a problem. I will get divorced. And she said, no, we don't make any major moves in our first year of sobriety. But I was obsessed. I know you understand this if you're in this room. I was obsessed. Clearly, he was the answer. God, as I could see it, had put him in my path. And so, you know how this goes. If you've been in AA any time at all, you would kind of dance around each other in meetings. You know, I'll tell you what. If you want something bad enough, you can convince yourself it's God's will and meant to be. And I convinced myself, and we sort of made, you know, set our plans. Now, it was complicated. I'm a married woman. Obviously, we're not going to go to my place. He was a newcomer. He did not have a place. But he didn't have a car either, but I had a car, and he had a job, and I'll tell you, where there's a will, there's a way. I was working at the time at a record company in Hollywood, and he was very conveniently also working in Hollywood at this porn bookstore, and it's the God's truth. And so I arranged this long lunch hour one day for somebody to cover for me, and I went down to the bookstore and picked him up, and we went to a motel on Sunset Boulevard and spent some time together, and I dropped him back off at the bookstore afterwards, and I'm driving back to my office, and it struck me that I was 10 months sober, and I was living exactly the way I had always lived. You know, I hadn't changed one single solitary thing. I'd been sitting in these meetings for 10 months, hearing you say night after night after night that I was going to have to change everything about the way I lived, or I was surely going to drink and die. And I hadn't changed a thing. The only reason I hadn't done that sooner is nobody had asked, you know. I felt real bad that day because I didn't think that I could change. I've always lived that way, and I just didn't think that I could change. I was afraid to tell my sponsor what I'd done because she had been very clear in her direction about this fellow. But I did tell her that very night because the bottom line here is I didn't want to drink. And I went and told my sponsor what I'd done, and she said to me, you know, Pat, you learned a real important lesson today. You've learned that you're probably not a woman who could cheat on her husband and stay sober, and that's a good thing to know. And you just don't have to live like that if you don't want to. Now, I didn't want to. I'll tell you the truth. I've never wanted to live that way. Drunk or sober, I never wanted to live that way. Certainly sober, more than anything, I don't want to. But I don't see that I can change. Wanting not to live that way with all my heart and soul does not make the obsession for this man go away. You know? What I did, and it sounds so simple when I stand up here and say it, but it was hard at the time. What I did is I stayed away from that guy a day at a time. You know, a day at a time I didn't drive by that bookstore or where he lived. A day at a time I didn't call him on the telephone. A day at a time I didn't take his calls when he called my office. And my thought was I should, and I ran this by my sponsor. I said, well, don't you think I should call him and explain what's going on here? And she said, no, I don't. She said, I think if you just quit talking to him, he'll get the idea. Seemed unnecessarily cruel to me, but Apparently he did get the idea, because eventually he stopped calling. And the real good news for me about that is that the obsession went away, and I don't live that way anymore, and I haven't since then. You know, I had no idea when I came here that I could change the way I lived my life. I had no idea whatsoever. What an incredible gift, you know. I was recently a year and a half ago now, secretary of my home group in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a big speaker meeting. We get about 900 people every Wednesday night at the speaker meeting, and everybody in that room knows who I am because I was at the podium every week doing these announcements, and everybody there knows who I am, and I know there's not a single person in that room who looks at me and thinks, oh yeah, Pat, she cheats on her husband, because I'm not that kind of a woman anymore, and that's the kind of woman I always was. You know, what a gift. What an incredible gift. I'd like to say something else about that, too, that I think is important, especially today. I mentioned to you that I had this person at work cover for me that day so I could go off and do this deed. You know how you have a friend at work who's the friend you like tell all your stuff to, and of course that's the friend who covered for me, and she knew where I was going and what I was doing that day. In fact, we talked about it after I got back, and a few months after that incident, I left that job, got a better job, and I left and went, but I stayed in touch with that lady because we were friendly, and we'd have lunch together every few months and catch up on news with each other. And about 2 years after I left that job, I heard through a third mutual friend that this first lady's husband had developed a really bad drinking problem, and that they had joined some rather strange church. And if you belong to a strange church, please do not. I have nothing against strange churches. I'm just trying to make a point here. God bless you if you do. They had joined this rather odd church in the hopes that his drinking problem would be alleviated. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, well, God, that's funny. I wonder why they wouldn't go to AA. I mean, she knew a lot about AA. We talked about it a lot. I wonder why she wouldn't sort of steer him towards Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, why would she? You know, what she saw about Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's a place where people cheat on their spouses. That's what I showed her. I don't think if I were her, I'd be inclined to direct my husband to Alcoholics Anonymous either. It really made me stop and think about the traditions. I think that's the first time I really started thinking about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a program of attraction, and I certainly did not make it attractive to those people. I don't know if that man ever got sober or not, but I'll tell you what, if he did, it's no thanks to anything I had to say or do. I've had the opportunity since then to be a much better example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think we have a real obligation. If we're going to let people out there know that we're sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, we got to behave in a way that's going to make them want to come here if they ever need it or recommend it to a friend or a loved one. It's just I feel real strongly about it. My first sponsor drank when I was about a year and a half sober, and I got a new sponsor. She was sober a long time, and I wondered what she had. She had happy, joyous sobriety. I wasn't even close. And I'm still whining and sniveling around the meetings. And she said to me, you know, I've watched you since you've been here, and you just whine and cry and feel so sorry for yourself, and you think you have this terrible husband. And she said, what I want you to do is a day at a time, I want you to act as though you're a kind and loving wife to that man. It was not an appealing idea. I did not like him. He did not like me. We did not get along. I remember I said to her, you know, I don't think that this marriage can be saved. And she said, perhaps not. Perhaps you're going to have to walk away from it down the road somewhere. But in the meanwhile, while you're still there, I want you just to act. Just pretend, you know, act like you're a kind and loving wife. And maybe by doing that, you can make some amends for some of that stuff that you've done to that man. And then if you do have to walk away down the road somewhere, maybe you'll be able to do it without any guilt. I liked the notion of erasing some of the guilt because I had a lot of it there. And so I became willing to try the things this lady suggested. First thing she told me to do was every day when I went home from work, I was to ask him how his day went and listen while he told me. And I didn't care. You know, I wasn't interested. My direction was to listen for a minimum of 10 minutes. First night, I kind of checked my watch and asked him how his day went. He looked a little surprised that I was asking, but he told me a couple of things that had happened at work, and they made absolutely no sense to me at all. I didn't know the people he was talking about. I'd never expressed any interest in them before. But he said a few things. When the 10 minutes were up, I left the room. And, you know, I was driving to the meeting that night, and I wasn't crying. And it took me a long time to realize why that was. You know, nothing had changed. We had the same fight that night before I left the house that we always had. But I wasn't crying in the car that night. And I understand today why that is. And the reason is because I had finally taken my focus off of the problem. And I was busy in the solution. You know, as soon as I get started in the solution, I feel better, no matter if the problem's still there or not. It's a matter of kind of changing my focus, and I felt better right away. Nothing changed for a long time, you know, but I felt a little bit better. Time passed. You know, I started watching women in AA and how they treated their husbands, and trying to do some of that stuff myself. Some of it I didn't like. you know. But I took what I could, and I took the sponsor's direction. One night I was saying my prayers, and my prayers were very, very simple in those days. In the morning, I would get on my knees and say, "Dear God, please help me stay sober today. Amen." And at night, I would get on my knees and say, "Dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today. Amen." I said that prayer because my sponsor told me to. I believe in God. I've always believed in God, but I felt absolutely no connection whatsoever saying that prayer. I only did it because I knew if I missed a day, that would be the day she'd say to me, "Say, have you been getting on your knees saying that prayer?" And I always wanted to be able to say yes, so I did it every day. And I was on my knees that particular night saying that prayer, "Dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today. Amen." And I started to get up, and I realized that I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it hadn't happened that day. It had happened already before, and I missed it. This is the biggest problem in my life, and I missed when it went away. I could not believe it. I remember I got back down on my knees, and I thanked God for... Well, first I tried to think, well, okay, it happened yesterday then. No, yesterday I felt good too. You know, well, then the day before. Well, last Saturday I felt good. I can't tell you when it happened. I was so busy in the solution that I literally had forgotten about the problem before it went away. Now, this is great stuff. These steps really work. I got back down on my knees and I thanked God for this new feeling. You know, I said, "God, I believe that if you mean for me to stay married to this man, that I could do that and stay sober and have a happy, joyous life." And I thanked him for that. It was the first time I had thanked God for anything other than just the physical business of being sober. Not too long after that, we found out that he had cancer. My very first thought was, boy, I wish this would have happened when I hated him. See, right away, I think about me. I am a selfish, self-centered woman. I was then, I am now. The good news is that I don't act on it nearly as much as I used to, but I'm still kind of basically that person. And my first thought is always for me. But, you know, I just kept doing what I was doing. And he was sick for a year and a half, and he did die, and it was tough. It was a hard year and a half, no question about it. But it was also the best year and a half of our marriage. By a million miles, it was the best year and a half of our marriage because of what you taught me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you taught me how to do that. When he died, I went down to this little chapel and made some funeral arrangements, and the day of the funeral came and a couple hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous showed up. Now, these people never met him, you know, but they came that day because they knew that I would need them, which, of course, I did. And sitting in that funeral chapel that day, I realized that what my sponsor had promised me really, really had come true. I felt sad about his death, but I felt right about my part in our relationship. I felt grateful that I had stayed there when every bit of my best judgment said, "Oh, get out of this marriage while you're still young and have your whole life ahead of you. Don't waste any time here." I am so grateful I was willing to listen to somebody else and do it somebody else's way, because I would have missed it all. And I'll tell you what, I believe not only would I have missed that incredibly good feeling that I had then about the fact that I really had made my amends to that man, but I would have missed what's happening to me today. You know, Vince and I have such a good life together, and I love this man so much. I mean, this is the way I always knew you ought to feel about a husband. I never did, but I always knew that you should, and I always kind of thought that I was lacking something, that it was, you know, that God just didn't give me that feeling or whatever. I know for me, for my part of this relationship with Vince, it would not be possible if I hadn't learned how to do it there with my late husband. You know, if you're new, you don't know the stuff that you're doing today that might seem so stupid and have nothing to do with anything. You don't know how it's going to touch your life 5 years or 10 years or 16 years or, I assume, 30 years from the time that you're doing it. You know, everything that I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous has had some effect further down the line in my sobriety. You know, it just continues to happen and continues to sort of unfold. It's incredible. It's just incredible. You taught me how to care about people. I remember I don't like people much. One of my early directions was I had to pick up these two old ladies, Claire and Zelda, one night a week and take them to the meeting. They lived in the same apartment building, and they were about 120 years old each, and they had both had emphysema, and they both smoked incessantly. And they'd get in my car, and they'd cough and hack, and I'd be terrified they were going to die. I didn't mind so much going to the meeting because I figured I'll get to the meeting, and there's people there, and I'll just open the door, and somebody will take them. But it worried me a lot driving home. They did not live conveniently to where I lived. I thought it was a terrible imposition. I had to go way out of my way, and I have the fight with my husband now. I got to drive clear across town and pick these two old ladies up, and I didn't like them at all, and I didn't want to do it, but I did it because my sponsor made me. And one night, I'd been doing it for a bunch of months, and one night I went to pick them up, and one of them was sick and couldn't make it to the meeting, and I found that I was really worried about her, and I called her up the next day to see how she was, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, that's not me, you know. A couple months later, I'd made a friend, Betty, who was was like my first friend in AA, and we were almost a year sober, I guess, at this time, and Betty had been quite heavy when she got sober, and she'd lost a lot of weight that first year of sobriety, really had been exercising and dieting, and you know how when you see somebody every day, you don't really notice them losing weight, and this particular day, she was walking towards me from across a yard and coming towards me, and it just struck me, wow, she really has lost a lot of weight, and she looks fantastic, and I felt happy for her. Now, I'm not the kind of woman who feels happy when other women lose weight. I mean, I'm just not. And I felt really, really happy for her. And I realized that I really cared for this woman. I mean, she really, really, honest to God, was my friend. I really loved her, and I felt happy when good things happened to her. And I believe that started with Claire and Zelda. You know, I mean, everything that I've done just has this, you know, this continuing effect. I'll talk about one other thing, and then I'll sit down. My other major problem when I got sober was my relationship with my stepfather. I really, really hated my stepfather, and I actually had pretty good reason to do so. But when I got to AA, I kept hearing you talk about resentment and the fact that we needed to get rid of resentment, particularly justifiable resentment, that we must find a way to get rid of it or we will drink and die. You're real clear on this point, and it seemed to me that... You know, this business with my stepfather was kind of one of my big secrets, one of those things I'm going to take to my grave and never tell anyone. So I finally became willing to write about it in my inventory because I didn't want to drink. And I wrote about it in my inventory, and I read it to my sponsor, and I thought that's going to be the end of it. Like, whew, thank God we got that over with, you know. But it wasn't. The longer I stayed sober, the more I thought about it, the harder it got to be cordial and civil to this man. He was married to my mother, you know, and when I'd go visit my mother or call her on the phone, it was real, real difficult for me to be nice to him. And... I don't know if this happens to you, but it happens to me all the time. Whatever I'm going through, it seems like every meeting I go to, that's what they're talking about. And every meeting I was going to, they were talking about these resentments. And I was afraid. I was afraid that I was going to drink someday if I didn't find a way to get rid of it. I prayed every single day about it. Every single day I asked God to remove this resentment, and nothing happened. And it finally was pointed out to me that there's... footwork for me. There's always footwork for me. I have never, in the entire 16 years I've been here, been able to just get on my knees, say a prayer, and have anything at all happen. Nothing ever happens. My deal is I got to say the prayer and then get up and take whatever the footwork is. There is always footwork. You know, from the very beginning when I said that prayer, we all said, oh, God, please help me, you know, stop drinking. That was the prayer, and the footwork was to call AA and come to these meetings. There is always footwork. So, okay, so there must be some footwork with this business with my stepfather, but I don't know what it is. My sponsor suggested that that I go make amends to him. I thought perhaps she had forgotten what I had told her. You know, if somebody should be making amends, actually he should be making them to me. But bottom line here, I didn't want to drink, so I became willing to go do this. She pointed out to me that I could just sort of use the same list, if you will, of things that I made amends to my mother for, you know, the grief and the anguish and the concern that I caused my mother all those years. He was living in the house at the same time I was causing my mom all that trouble. Presumably he was a little concerned too. And I mean, I love my mother. I'm sorry, you know, but I don't love this guy at all. What do I care? But I don't want to drink. So I go out and I have this little chat with him, and I tell him I know I haven't been a very good stepdaughter to him, and I'm really sorry about that, and I know I can't take away those years, but I'm going to try to do better from this point forward. And I left right away because I was afraid if I hung around I might wander off into discussing his shortcomings, and the book is very clear that we're not to do that. And so I left, and they lived about 50 miles away. It was quite a drive coming back, and as I'm driving back in the car, I thought, well, these steps don't work every time, because now I've done it, and I still hate him as much as I ever did. These steps just don't work on this. It was pointed out to me by my sponsor that that's not really the amend. That's like the announcement of the amend, but the amend is now, in fact, to be a kind and loving stepdaughter. What an order. I can't go through with it. You know, I just don't think I can do this. But I began to try. The first thing she had me do is whenever I called my mother every week, if he answered the phone instead of saying, let me talk to Mom, I would say, hello, how are you? Let me talk to Mom. Which might not sound like a big deal, but trust me when I tell you it was a very big deal. I would be sweating when I dialed the phone. I was so uncomfortable, but I'd dial that phone, and then somebody said, you know, a kind and loving daughter might actually chat with him a little bit too, and so I'd try to think of topics I could chat with him about. I mean, I don't even want to say hello to him. I can't even think of anything I'd want to chat with him about. I think of them as generic topics. You know, if I'd seen a movie that week, it was a great topic. When the Olympics were in L.A., God, I used that one for weeks and weeks, you know. And so I'd call and I'd ask him how he was, and then I'd chat about my little nothing topics, and, oh, God, it was so hard. Christmas was coming up that first year and that I was doing this. I was maybe 4 or 5 years sober, I guess, when I started doing this. And I thought, well, you know, I didn't think this. Somebody said it to me. I never really had an original idea. Everything you hear that's any good, I didn't think it. Somebody in AA told it to me. This lady said, you know, a kind and loving daughter would not rush out on Christmas Eve, pick up a shirt, and have the store wrap it and give him that for Christmas. I don't know how she knew I was planning to do that, but I said, well, okay. So I went down to this shopping mall, and I was looking around for something, you know, that he might actually like or use or appreciate. And I was in this needlepoint shop, and they had this thing to needlepoint and frame to hang on the wall, a saying about fathers and daughters. Just a sickening saying about fathers and daughters. I mean, I thought, I cannot do this. But I did. I bought it. I did it. I did my, you know, needlework takes, needlepoint takes a lot of hours. I did my nicest work. I never for a moment felt the sentiment. But I got it framed nicely when I was done. I took it over there at Christmas. And there was a moment when we opened our gifts that year, a spiritual experience, in fact. When he opened that gift up, he got a tear in the corner of his eye. That's all. But I'll tell you what, it was an incredible moment. I knew that I was on the right track. I knew in that split second, hearing gone that fast, that if I kept trying to do what I was trying to do, that God was going to make this resentment bearable enough that I would not have to pick up a drink over it. I didn't know how. Understand that I still hated him as much as I ever did, but that just little split second, I knew that somehow I was on the right track. I kept doing what I was doing. That's all. You know, years passed. One time he was in the hospital, I went to visit him and chatted with him there by the bed. And when I got up to leave, I bent over and I kissed him on the forehead and I said, goodbye, I love you. And I was all the way out to my car before I realized what I'd said. I was trying to put the key in the door and it struck me what I'd said up there and I couldn't believe it. Because the fact of the matter is that it was true. I did love him and I don't know how that happened. And you know, it's exactly like what happened with my late husband. It didn't happen. I didn't start loving this stepfather that day in the hospital. It had happened a long time before and I'd missed it. You know, I'd been so busy acting like a kind and loving daughter, apparently, that I had in fact become a kind and loving daughter. The last couple of years sort of developed some dream. I believe that he was a practicing alcoholic the years that I was growing up. I know we're not supposed to pronounce other people alcoholics, but I think he was. He didn't drink the last few years, but he got real, real crazy and was in and out of mental hospitals a couple of times. And in June, he didn't really commit suicide because I don't think he was in his right mind, but he jumped off the roof of their house and he died a week later. You know, when he did that, my mother called me right away because she knew that I would be of some comfort to her. Now, isn't that amazing? This is the woman that I call and torment in the middle of the night with my drunken phone calls. And the very first person she called was me because she knew that I would be of comfort and service to her, which, of course, I was, you know. I went out there and I don't think after that, it was a week from the time that he fell or whatever until he died. And I don't think during that, except for the first day that he knew who I was, but or that he was even really conscious. But I would go out there and I would sit for a few minutes by his bed and then I would go do whatever I could do for my mother, you know. And I'll tell you what, there was never a moment during that week where I would think to myself, gosh, I wish he'd wake up so I could say something to him, you know, because I didn't need to say anything. Everything that I needed to say to him had been said years and years and years ago. Everything that I needed to do to let him know that I loved him had been done consistently for years and years now, you know. I'll tell you what, it's just another example of how grateful I am that I have been willing to listen to other people and do it other. My mind told me this guy is the bad guy. I don't need to do anything here. He's the one who should be doing something. I would have missed this all if I had listened to my mind, if I hadn't been willing to listen to my sponsor and do it her way. And I like to say something else, too, if you're new, because I think it's confusing in Alcoholics Anonymous today. Vince touched on it a little bit last night. I like to be real, real clear on this. What I have done here is Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't found it necessary to go to any other programs, 12-step or otherwise, or to go to any kind of therapy or do any. And I'm not putting any of these things down. I simply want to make it real clear that if you're an alcoholic of my type, Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it works very good all by itself. I'm very grateful that I haven't muddied it up with a lot of other stuff that would distract me from the spiritual business at hand here. But you're new, I want to say three things. You need to do three things if you're new that I recommend highly. Get a sponsor. If you don't have one, get one before you leave this room today. You don't have to audition people to find just the right person. You know, what you need is somebody who's sober, who's taken these steps, who can walk you through them. It doesn't have to be somebody who's married or single or has children or matches your particular case. It needs to be somebody who's sober, who's taken these steps. The second thing I recommend that you do is get a home group, a place where if you don't show up, someone's going to miss you and give you a call and maybe save your life. And the third thing I highly recommend is making a friend about your length of sobriety. You know, I mentioned, I think, earlier, my friend Betty. Betty was sober 3 days less than me, which, of course, I never let her forget. And we'd call each other every day, and Betty was the person I'd called before I called my sponsor, you know, and kind of, sometimes you like to hear yourself say this stuff out loud before you actually say it to your sponsor. And I'd call Betty always with the hope that Betty would say whatever it was that I was talking about, that Betty would say, oh, that's not so bad, you know, like a good friend should. Betty always said the same thing, which was, oh, my God, you better call your sponsor right now. And you need a friend like that. So if you're new, I hope you do those three things, and I hope that nobody in this room ever has to take another drink again a day at a time. Thank you.